I was totally afraid that I was going to make a comment and the next person to share would say something like, "No, what Chris said was really dumb. And let me explain why." I was like terrified that that was going to happen. So finally I shared some. I mean, this is the way it was. I was scared to get a sponsor. I was terrified. It was like going up and asking a man to dance. You know what I mean? I was totally embarrassed about it. I'm like this real loser, you know, and my whole life is in shambles, and I was wondering if I could call you twice a day and, you know, dump all my junk on you. You look like you're doing pretty well, you know. I mean, who would want to do that? So I was afraid of doing that. I was afraid of celebrating. I couldn't believe it. My sponsor talked me into celebrating. He said, "Chris, you're going to celebrate." I'm like, "Why?" He goes, "Because it's a good thing to do, and we do it." But why do I have to do it? So finally I said, "Okay, I'll celebrate." So he signs me up. I don't know it, but he signed me up to a Morristown meeting with 150 people. I couldn't believe it. I'm sitting there going, I'm going to have to get up and say something, and I'm just going to blither incoherently. I know it. I'm not going to be able to talk. I'll tell you what, I was desperate enough to walk through the fear on all these things. I had to. I would not have survived if I didn't get firmly involved with Alcoholics Anonymous. I just never would have survived. So I went up and I celebrated, and I said something really profound like, "I thought you didn't tell me there'd be this many people. Thank you." You know, and they said, "Chris, you did really well. You did good. But I did it, you know what I mean? And slowly I was able to walk through the fear. I mean, you know, and today I'm able to do something like this, which if I am such a different person today because of this spiritual process. I'm not even the type of person I would have liked when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? People like me pissed me off when I was new. The solution people. I wanted to hang with the guys that were dying, you know? I wanted to hang with the guys that, you know, no license, you know? Living in the Maytag box. I felt more at home with those people. But I'll tell you what, this process works. And if there's anybody in here who has some fears that they know are blocking them off from a happy, joyous, and free life, just trust in this process. Trust in this process. Do these inventories the way we have it laid out. You know, don't let your ego talk you out of doing this work. Our ego wants to talk us out of doing these inventories. "Oh, that's too complicated," or, "Oh, you know, whatever."
It wants to talk you back under the bar stool. That's where your ego's trying to get you.
Absolutely. So don't let the ego win. Let the spirit self win. The spirit self is saying, "Hey, you know, I want to do this inventory. I want to get happy, joyous, and free. I want all that I can get out of life." And that's absolutely true.
There's a couple quotes. One of the things that Chris talked about is, it's a great quote by Robert Frost. He says, "The best way out is always through." And that's what they're talking about with fear. One of the big fears that I see run into a lot of times is between the resentment inventory and the fear inventory, there's a series of prayers. We're praying for the person because they're spiritually sick like us. It's a tremendous fear. We are afraid to forgive them. Because if we forgive them, they get off the hook. And the executioner, you know, the hitman, is sitting there saying, "You cannot forgive that person because they haven't paid. They haven't suffered the way that in your mind you had this picture for them to suffer." You know? And until they suffer that slow dying death, I will never forgive them. I will not let go of that resentment. And what are you really afraid of? You're afraid of letting them off the hook. You're afraid that God isn't going to take care of them for you. You know? Let him be the judge. You're still trying to run the show. And Emmett Fox has a couple things on forgiveness. He says, "The forgiveness of others is the vestibule of heaven. You have to get rid of all resentments and condemnation of others, and not least self-condemnation and remorse. You have to forgive yourself, but you cannot forgive yourself sincerely until you have forgiven others first. Of course, nothing in all the world is easier than to forgive people who have not hurt us very much. But what the law of being requires us is that we forgive the very thing that are so hard to forgive that at first seems impossible to do at all. Setting others free means setting yourself free, because resentment is really a form of attachment. It is the cosmic truth that it takes two to make a prisoner, the prisoner and the jailer. There is no such thing as being a prisoner on one's own account. Moreover, the jailer is as much the prisoner as his charge. When you hold resentment against anyone, you are bound to that person by a mental chain. You are tied by a cosmic tie to the thing that you hate. The one person, perhaps in the whole world, whom you most dislike is the very one to whom you are attaching yourself by a hook that is stronger than steel. The object of your resentment will be drawn again into your life, perhaps to work further havoc. By forgiveness, you set yourself free, you save your own soul. Pretty impressive stuff. Now I know why they spent a lot of time studying them thoughts in the beginning. The last instruction, instruction number 10, on the fear inventory, we ask God to direct our attention to what he would have us be, not what he would have us do. This fits in. We're going to start talking a lot about vision. Bill Wilson was big on it. Part of becoming a recovered alcoholic, we recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. The state of body that we recover from is the need for physical craving. When we put down the drink, we are recovered physically. Recovering mentally is we get the power to use our minds back as we go through the steps. And we get to 10 and 11, he talks a lot about getting our thought life back. He talks a lot about vision. And I think this feathers in pretty well. He wants us to ask ourselves and ask God what he would have us be, not what he would have us do. Because we're looking for vision. When it comes to me, it's something like God wants me to be a better person, a better father, a better husband, a better employee, a better citizen, a better driver, a more considerate individual. And it helps me get some goal. I'll never get there, but I now have some place that I can go towards in the direction. Because remember, we strive for spiritual perfection, right? You know? It's a direction. And if you have vision, you can have a finish line, but you're never going to get there. At least you have a place to go. And I think that's why it's really important on that on the fear inventory to be praying for vision, for praying for God to show you what he wants you to be. Because deep down inside, it's our concept. We don't have to climb in God's head. It's our concept of what we think God wants. We know in our heart of hearts, we know right from wrong. We know what we should be doing. Our ego is what gets in the way and says, don't do that, go drink. Make the pain go away. If you remove that and you have a relationship with God, then he just says, okay, what does God want me to be? He wants me to be a better husband, a better AA, a better citizen, you know, and not cut people off. It's that simple. It's a simple program. It's not a real complex thing. It's pretty basic stuff, you know. Page 12 has got the fear tool that I talked about a little bit. It's right there for you. All right? Flip the page. Page 13, sex inventory. All right? People say that there are no instructions in the Big Book for the sex inventory. I just went through a Big Book workshop, and the person that was leading the Big Book workshop said there's no instructions for the fear inventory, and there's no instructions for the sex inventory. Well, we just covered, 10 instructions for the fear inventory. Here are the four instructions we got for the sex inventory, right? We try to be sensible. Very difficult for an alcoholic, right? We review our own conduct over the years past. We're given 9 questions on page 69:1. There's 9 questions buried in there. We reviewed our conduct over the years past, where we had been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, whom have we hurt, could be unjustifiably aroused jealousy, unjustifiably aroused suspicion, unjustifiably aroused bitterness. Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and we looked at it. Those are instructions. I drew out a little example of what I do with guys when I say, hey, show me how to do a sex inventory. This is what I give them. And once again, you can take it out of the book and Xerox it if you want to use it. who is the relationship with inside this box on page 13? Put down the name. It was with Susie. Okay. How did you meet? The reason I put this down, what I'm going to do, ask you to do when you're writing a sex inventory, you'll start to see themes in your life. And it comes really, it's really not part of the sex inventory, it's part of the sex ideal. A lot of people have never heard of the sex ideal, but it's one of the things we're supposed to do in connection with the sex inventory is come up with an ideal. And I'll show you those instructions in a minute. But in order to make this ideal, how do I come up with an ideal? Well, one of the things I found in my own sex inventory every single woman that I had relations with, it was love at first sight. I saw her across the room. I kept meeting the women in my life over and over again the same exact way. And it didn't become clear to me until I answered this question, how did I meet? And I started to see it. Well, I met her. It was love at first sight. I met, you know, was it love at first sight? I put it right down there. Yes, it was love at first sight. How long did you date before you had sex? You know, huge player for most of us, you know. I always tried, my goal was to get into her shorts as fast as possible. I had one thing in mind and that was it, all right? When it comes time to create your sex ideal, since that has always turned into a terrible situation, it has never worked for you, learn from your own experience. Your sex ideal will read, someone with whom I won't sleep right away. Whoa, learn from my past experience. If it never worked out before, flip it around. If it was something good, if it was something you had in common, you notice the next question, what are some of the good things about the relationship? We had things in common. That was something good. That transitioned straight across to a sex ideal. Someone with whom I'll have things in common. You know? If going to bed on the first date was something bad, like I said, you just flip it around. Someone with whom I won't do that behavior. Transition straight across to a sex ideal. The reason those questions are there are to help it make it easier to create the ideal. It's not really part of the sex inventory, but I put it in here because this is where you're going to be doing your writing anyway. Then there's the 9 questions on that sheet. Flip the page. Page 14 of the guide. The sex ideal. I wrote a little blurb underneath it. It says, the sex ideal is formed between you and God. Take the high points from your past relations and experiences and transfer them directly to your ideal. Take the negatives and low spots from your sex experience and take their opposites and transfer that to your ideal. Here are the instructions we're given for the sex ideal. There's 15 of them. Jesus, 4 instructions for a sex inventory and 15 for an ideal. Think maybe the ideal is important? How many times have you been sitting in an AA meeting and everybody says AAs don't know how to have relationships? We are dysfunctional. But 12 and 12 says that it's the cause of our alcoholism, is dysfunctional personal relationships. If you're coming to AA to learn how to have relationships, chances are you're coming to the wrong place unless the person's done an ideal and they can show you how to unlock your own key to your own prison with your own experience. All right? Look at these instructions. Number 1, we subject each sex relation to the test, was it selfish or not? Well, I can pretty much guarantee the answer to that one. That's kind of a no-brainer, but they ask it anyway. 2, we ask God to mold our ideal. This is an ideal between you and God. You're all, you know the expression, you're not supposed to have relationships in the first year? Where'd that come from? I've never read it in the big book, you know? You know, and as Mark Houston says, we don't know whether it works because nobody's ever done it. You know? So we ask God to mold your ideal. 3, we ask God to help us live up to that ideal. That means it's a prayer. There's going to be an ideal prayer in here, right? 4, remember always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. 5, we must be willing to grow towards our ideal. 6, we must be willing to make amends where we have done harm. 7, we ask God what to do about each specific matter. 8, we let God be the final judge of our ideal. 9, we realize that some people are as fanatical as others are loose. This is a very touchy area. You will find people going to all kinds of extremes when they talk about it. Some people say you can do it. I know a guy who says, hey, when I came to AA, they only told me I had to stop drinking. And he's gone through like 4 marriages. He keeps having an affair. He sleeps with a gun under his pillow, and he's got like 24 years of sobriety because he's afraid people are going to try to kill him. Rightly so. You know? I don't have... He does not have what I want. I want nothing that man has. You know? And he's a good friend of mine. Ken, we avoid hysterical thinking or advice. That's hard for alcoholics, hysterical thinking. 11, we pray for the right ideal. There it is again. 12, we pray for guidance in each questionable situation. Look at this one. 13, magic number, and look what it says. We pray for sanity. We need sanity. We're insane. 14, we pray for strength to do the right thing. 15, if sex is very troublesome for you, throw yourself the harder into helping others and think of their needs and work for them. And it quiets the imperious urge. The definition, I put it right down there for you. Imperious is arrogant, overbearing, urgent, or compelling. Right? And since the sex ideal is between you and God, it's kind of hard for me to sit down and say, this is how it is. And it's a hard area to explain. And since I've been asked so many times about a sex ideal, what I finally decided to do, and I okayed it with my wife, was I put my last ideal for my last inventory right here. It's on the page. That's it. So it sees you, so you can see what an ideal looks like. An ideal is what you want from a perfect relationship. But that's selfish. Don't just put down in the ideal what you want. Put down in the ideal what you're willing to bring to the relationship. Not only do what is it I want from this person that I'm going to be involved with, what am I willing to bring to that relationship? And down it came. When I typed it out on the computer, it just happened to have 12 bullet statements. Just a coincidence, you know. But here's my idea, you know. I highly encourage you, if you've been divorced, if you've had multiple relationships, if you're not currently in a relationship, if you're having trouble with personal relationships, you know, take a look at your ideal. It's probably a reason you're having some serious troubles. You're either arousing jealousy, suspicion, anger. What kind of jealousy? Not just jealousies with other people, you know, like my wife thinks I'm going to cheat on her. Rivalry between the relationships. That little bitter rivalries and things where we challenge each other and it, you get these little sick games that are going on, that's creating jealousy within the marriage, within the relationship. You know? It's all those things. When you sit down and meditate about this stuff, that's why we need God's help, to come in and guide us and direct us on our inventories. So what have we looked at? We've looked at three inventories. We looked at resentment inventory, right? From the resentment inventory, we got column four, question four, which is where was I frightened, right? That transitions straight over to our fear inventory, okay? We got a fear inventory. Out of our fear inventory, we have a hit parade of our fears. Those fears trigger our character defects. So we now have a prayer. We give those fears to God, ask God to remove them, and at once we commence to outgrow fear. What a great tool that is. You can use it all the time, not just when you write an inventory. When you see your character defect, stop. Say, okay, God, I must be afraid. What am I afraid of? Remove it. Boom. It's gone. We end up with a list of the harms we've done to others. It's part of the questions, nine questions. Question number eight is, where were you at fault? And nine, what should you have done instead? You're going to come up with the people you've hurt, the majority of them, when you're writing your inventory. When you do a good four step, the way the big book tells you to, you have done all the work you need for step four, step five, step six, step seven, and step eight. You got all the tools ready to rock. Now you're ready to sit down, explain to another person what you did wrong, and go through the spiritual process it takes to finish this work. That's why, way back when, that one line that I said, did you really think Billy Wilson really meant it when he wrote it, that nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty? That's why four-step inventory is the key to your future. Because we're doing the basic spiritual work, laying the ground blocks for the rest of our sobriety. And we get a lot of tangible results when we've done this. You got anything else?
The only thing I'd like to say is we've looked at resentments. That's who we're mad at. We've looked at fears. That's what we're afraid of. We've looked at sex harms and harms to others. That's what we're guilty and remorseful for. That takes care of a lot of the uncomfortability in our lives. We're immediately addressing. We're looking for some truth about the real blatant problems that we have in our emotional nature. And it is very important stuff. And like Dave says, the rest of the steps will all benefit from a thorough four-step. The four-step really is the information. That's the truth. And then we work with it from there with the rest of the steps.
Let's take one more example. Let's say you got a guy. He goes in and he steals $50 out of the open cash register drawer at a gas station. All right? Comes time for him to do his inventory. He wasn't angry at the guy, so the guy doesn't end up on the resentment inventory. He was not afraid of the guy, so the guy doesn't end up on the fear inventory. And he didn't have sex with the guy, so he doesn't end up on the sex inventory. But there was a definite harm done. Remember I said this is a harm done to others inventory with emphasis on sex? We're given one more instruction that we missed. Took the page over to the guide to page 15. On 70:3, and it says, we have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct, not just our conduct through resentment, fear, and sex, any kind of harms in our conduct. That includes people that we steal money from, or, you know, lying, cheating, stealing, adultery, assault, verbal abuse, damage to property, you know, ripping off your next-door neighbor's lawnmower. You know, there's a guy that Chris sponsors. He stole a lawnmower for some church, and every time he drove by the church, it was killing him. You know, he wasn't mad at the church. He wasn't afraid of the church. He didn't have sex with the church, but it was killing him inside until he returned the damn lawnmower.
So I made him go back and make direct amends to the minister at the church. And the minister, of course, was very happy to get the money for the old lawnmower. But what he did was he asked for another thing. He goes, you know what else I'd like you to do to set right this wrong? I'd like you to write a letter about what's going on with you and your recovery and what's happened to you so that I can read it to my congregation. And he wrote one of the most beautiful letters I've ever heard in my life, talking about how he was a drug addict, alcoholic, and how he got involved with Alcoholics Anonymous, got involved with the spiritual principles of recovery, and how he's changed and how he's now actively trying to set right the wrongs that he's done in the past. And the minister, when he read this to the congregation, it blew them away. So he was able to touch maybe 100 to 200 people with this one amends. We will never, ever know what happens as a result of this step work. We can never guess. But when it's positive, work that we do, trying to align our will with God's, amazing things happen. Amazing things happen.
Joe Hawk and Mark Houston, two other big book guys that go around a lot, they talk about a kid. They say, you know, if you get a kid, he's got all these beat up toys and they're his favorite toys. If you were to go to that kid and say, you know what, go up to your bedroom and inventory all those toys so I know what's up there, and I'll take you to this toy store and I'll buy you brand new ones better than anything you got up there, the kid would knock you down to go do it. And that's basically what we're telling you here. Go back into your past, take a look what's there, inventory what's in there, and I'm going to give you a set of tools that are going to change your life, and they're all spiritual. And they will last you, and the byproduct of those tools is you will never want to take another drink of alcohol for the rest of your life. It will set you free. You will find the power, peace, happiness, and a sense of direction. Those are the promises this book promises us. And Chris and I are living proof that if you do this work, you do what we do, and that's all we're showing you is what we do, I guarantee you, you will get what we got. You know.
And another way to look at the promises is look at them as guideposts. Let's say you come across a promise and you say to yourself, oh, that's not true in my case. Well, go back a little bit from there and see which spiritual exercise you did not take. Because these promises always materialize if we work for them. That's another promise. And I'll tell you, in my own personal experience and my experience working with others, the people that work through this process to the best of their ability always achieve the promises, and it surprises the hell out of them. You know what I mean? It surprises these people. But it's to the point where I'm not surprised anymore. I'm kind of expecting it. You know?
Absolutely.
It's a great process.
We've covered a lot of material, a lot of ground. We got a break for dinner, and then there's going to be a meeting, so like they said, don't leave your stuff around if you don't want it to sprout legs and walk. Before you guys get up and walk out of here, we have touched some stuff that I'm sure, doing the column three stuff, doing the theater of the lie, we've gone into your souls and we stirred the pot. So let's get quiet for a second and thank God for this experience that we've had and ask Him to keep us safe and protected until we get back here again tonight after the meeting. All right? Okay, welcome back. The last thing we talked about was the fourth step, and as you remember, we asked God to take us out of that place. So since we're going to be talking about some important stuff tonight, why don't we go through the ritual that we're trying to have this relationship with a higher power. So why don't we get quiet for a second, and then Chris will bring us in a prayer. I just make it up.
Hey, grown up. God, thank you for bringing us to this place today. Thank you for showing us a little bit of your will through the revelation in this work. Please allow us all to see a little bit more truth about ourselves as we go through a little bit more of this process tonight. Amen.
Amen. Now, we finished up with the fourth step. I know it was kind of fast. I got several questions as soon as we finished. Does anybody have any questions they want to talk about now? Anything we didn't cover? Any questions you still have with the fourth step before we go on? No? Pretty easy? Okay. You'll notice in your guides, if you go to page 15, we jump right from the fourth step to the tenth step. Why would we do such a crazy thing like that? What happened to the middle steps? We're alcoholic, exactly. Let's go to page 84:2. Says, this thought brought us to step 10. What thought? Would they just get done reading the nine-step promises? You know? The concept, that the thought is that they will materialize if we work for them. That's the thought that leads us up to this point, right? Which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Look at this next sentence. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. Well, when do we start to clean up our past? When we start taking a look at the damage we did in a fourth step. So this instruction connects the 10th and 11th steps to the fourth step. They're connected. How does the 11th step get connected? At the end of the 10th step, it says, once we get done with step 10, we should look immediately at step 11. So 10 and 11 are connected to 4 by this connection. That's why we're jumping directly from 4 to 10 and 11. There's no sense in going through the four-step inventory and all that writing, that thoroughness, that honesty, writing out the four columns, writing out the fear inventory, writing out the sex inventory, writing out a sex ideal. And let's say that process takes you a month and a half to clean this big pile of crap that you've allowed to accumulate over however many years of drinking. And you clean up that entire pile of crap, and during that time period, in that month time period, you created a whole other pile. You know? That's the reason it takes us right to 10-11. If we're going to start to clean our past slate, let's keep the current slate clean while we're in this process. You know, that's the whole purpose of it. That reminds me, one of the questions I got that at the end of the fourth step was on the sex ideal. And the sex ideal is what you, it's an ideal, which it's between you and your God. It's what you expect out of your relationship with your higher power and your relationship with this other person. It is an ideal. How do you use it as a tool? That was the question that was brought to me. I knew there was one thing about the first step I want to talk about before we got going. Let's say you're going through life, you're single, you've got your sex ideal, you're happy in sobriety, and you meet the one, you think. Now you have a tool. The first time in your life you had a relationship, that you're going into a relationship and you have a tool. You've got your past, which you've turned into an ideal, and now you have something to compare to. And you find this person, you look at them, and you say, you know what? They're 55% of my ideal. Now remember, it's an ideal. You will never find 100%, but it's an ideal. What do you do with it? It's between you and your God. You and God made this ideal together. Now you've got to sit down and say, this person is 55% of what I've ever dreamed as being the perfect person. Can I live with that 55%? If they never change, if that other 45% never, ever changes, am I willing to be happy with that? Do they have what I need? And you sit down with prayer and meditation, and the answer will come. The only thing I can, it's the analogy of the rose. If I explain to you in detail what a rose smells like, and you've never smelled what a rose smells like, you don't know. But once you've smelled the rose, all I have to do is say, hey, it smells like a rose. And you go, oh. Well, it's that way with an ideal. You draw the thing up, if you've never drawn one up, and the first time you come to use it, you sit down, you take a look at it, you go, this person has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and they're missing 6, 7, 8. Can I live with that? God, show me if this person is compatible. Can I work with that as a starting point? Can I grow and change with this person? Can I love what they have? Can I love the best of them and not hate the worst of them? And God will show you. It's like the smelling of the rose. It just happens. I can't describe it any better than that. It's in something you've got to experience. You know. And remember, the ideal isn't just what you want, because that's selfish. It's what are you willing to step over to this higher power? If it's meant to be, it'll be. And it's not your job to figure it out. You know? God will show you. It's your job to maintain His will. Remember the promise? He will provide what you need if you stick close to Him and do His work well. There's no guarantee that you're going to have a good relationship in there. Maybe He will, maybe He won't. Maybe you'll get this vision, you're supposed to be a monk in Tibet. Who the hell knows? I don't know. You know? One of my friends does that. He's now living in Dar es Salaam, India, and he prays and meditates 6 hours a day. That's where his program, his process has taken him. You know? Who knows? You know, that's not for us to judge. Anyway, that's off the track. That's about the sex ideal. If you haven't tried it, write one out and give it a shot and see where it takes you. You know, I did not write an ideal. I had an ideal because I was single. I met my wife, and I stopped writing ideals when I did inventory. I went for 10 years without writing another ideal. And then it suddenly occurred to me and said, wait a minute, that's my prejudice. I'm not the same person who wrote the original ideal. Why don't I write another ideal? And I did not write it with my wife in mind. I went into prayer and meditation. I wrote the ideal. I came out. I put it aside. I left it on the computer. I didn't look at it that night. The next day, I turned the computer on, pulled up the ideal and read it, and compared it to what I already had in my life, and I was astounded at the blessings that I've already got and how close my wife fits my ideal. It was a true blessing. It was a turning point in my relationship. Now, when I write inventory, even though I'm in a committed relationship, I still write an ideal because it allows God, it allows me a closer connection to this power greater than myself. It increases my conscious contact, and that's what I'm looking for today. Does that make sense? Cool. So, Chris is going to take us through step 10. That's, now you know the connection between step 4 and step 10. Let's see what step 10 has to deal with.
Thanks, Dave. It says here, we've entered the world of the Spirit. I love it when they use this type of language. I believe that through a lot of these spiritual exercises, my spirit begins to awaken. And right around this time, it's expected of us, if we've done the work up to this point, remember that as you go through this book, it's literally expected that you do the exercises before you move on. So as we move into step 10 here, we should be well on our way to a spiritual awakening. So we've entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. One of the other misconceptions that was going around for many, many years was that steps 10, 11, and 12 were your maintenance steps. You were supposed to maintain your sobriety and your spiritual condition by using steps 10, 11, and 12. This sentence basically tells us that these are growth steps. These are steps that it's now time for us to grow spiritually. We've cleaned up some of the past, and now we're to move out and grow toward God's will. And this is not an overnight matter. It certainly wasn't in my case. It's taken a lot of work and a lot of time. And you know, anybody that was close to me had to be able to accept slow, painful progress. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. There's an instruction. Where do those come from? Those certainly sound to me like four-step items. So we're to continue to watch for these four-step items. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. So that's step 7, step 5, and step 9. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. That's step 12. Love and tolerance of others are our code. I like to look at step 10 as a step where you grab all the spiritual tools that have been made available to you and work them on a daily basis when you need to. It's like the day at a time step for me. Here are some of the promises, some of the 10-step promises, which are really good. And I've been to a lot of meetings where they talk about the 12 promises. I've been to a lot of meetings where they have the 12 promises up on the wall. I kind of think that's kind of shortchanging this whole process. Dave was talking before he stopped counting the promises at over 200. Each action step has positive promises, positive and negative promises, attached to them. And these are just like the 9th step promises. They always materialize if we work for them. And some of the 10th step promises are amazing. As a matter of fact, some of them really go contrary to a lot of the things that you hear in meetings today. Let's just look at a few of them. We've ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. You know, that's a highlight for some of us. You know, that certainly is a bonus. The sanity that precedes the first drink. When we get to this point, we're safe and protected. A lot of the guys that I work with who are balking on the fourth step or, you know, they're somewhere in the process, I let them know that they are not safe and protected from alcohol until they get to this point in step 10 where it's promised to them. You're running on the grace of God until this point. And I'll tell you what, the grace of God sometimes only lasts as long as ignorance or balking. You know, if you start to, I've seen too many people in the middle of this, the step process get to a point where they rest on their laurels. You know, they've done enough work for now, thank you. And they end up drunk. It doesn't surprise me anymore. I used to get real surprised when people drank. Nowadays, it's getting a little bit more predictable for me because I'm seeing where they come up short with the step process. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we will recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We will react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. What a gift this is. You know, we had admitted earlier that we were powerless over alcohol. That if we had an alcoholic mind, the time and the place would come when we would pick up another drink. And there's little or nothing that we could do about it. We're at a point now where it's being promised to us that we're going to react sanely and normally. Even in drinking situations, even around alcohol, we're going to be at a place where we're not going to be susceptible to it. I talked earlier about buying the gallon of vodka. You know, something like that is just not going to happen if I've been diligent up to this point. We'll see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. I like to look at it like I'm under the grace of God until I get really involved in this process, until I start to achieve a conscious contact with God. And then I'm sober because of the conscious contact with God. He's relieving me of the obsession to drink and doing a lot of other things in my life that are positive too. But there was a period of time when I was as powerless as I've ever been before I got to a point in the step process where I know it wasn't me keeping myself sober, but for some reason I was sober. I believe it had a lot to do with my willingness to go through this process and the grace of God that was granted to me because of my willingness. I've seen this a lot in the people that I work with. When you turn away from the process, you're kind of pulling the carpet out from underneath you as far as the grace of God is concerned. You know, I believe that God will do for me the things that I can't do for myself, but I have to participate in the process. I have to participate in the process or else it's just not going to happen. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. I feel that way today. I feel safe and protected from alcohol. I don't worry about it. If there was a bottle up on this table right now, it probably wouldn't cause me too much concern. You know what I mean? I know what it is. I know what it can do to me, and I react sanely and normally in its presence. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. A great bunch of promises. We're neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. This is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And there's the qualifier. We need to keep in fit spiritual condition. How do I keep in fit spiritual condition? The way I do it is I keep consistent with my meeting attendance. I work through the 12 steps to the best of my ability yearly or sometimes it takes me a year and a half to get through it, but I continue the process. I go in for the annual or semi-annual house cleaning. A lot of times I do different types of experiences through the steps with different people. The last fifth step I did it with Dave and one of his sponsees and one of my sponsees. And it was a multiple fifth step. And it was quite interesting. I'll talk more about it when we're on step five. But I'm open to new experiences with this process. Because each time I go through it, I get taken to a new level. And it's always very rewarding. And I don't want to ever be the type of person with a closed mind that is totally set in their ways. I always want to be open to the point where I can learn, where I can try different experiences, see what works, see what doesn't work, and grow from that, and continue to learn about this process. A year from now, I'll probably have different ideas about some of the step work because I'll have different experiences. And that's okay. One of the things that really gets to me is when I sit in a group and the people that I've been in the group with for years and years and years are still repeating the same experience they had back in like 1978 when they went through the steps. And they continue to talk about what their experience was back in 1978. And I never want to get to that point. I always want to have current experience to share. I always want to have new things to talk about and new experiences to talk about because I believe that my spiritual condition needs to grow. I need to grow in effectiveness and understanding. And to do that, sometimes I have to try different things. It's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. And I like to consider laurels yesterday's accomplishments, like that inventory I did in 1978. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. That was one of our questions that we asked everybody to talk about. There is no cure for alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Again, they're talking about maintaining your spiritual condition, and I do that with the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous, meaning step service. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. There's a good prayer. These are thoughts that must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish, for it's the proper use of the will. I love that. They tell you willpower is no good against the first strength. And I believe that's true. I believe that when I'm in a point where I'm powerless over alcohol because I have not gotten in touch with that which can keep me away from alcohol, where the hell am I? I lost my train of thought. Willpower, right, exactly. And memory power, too, probably. I believe that willpower is not really effective against the first drink. But here's the thing. I've had a guy relapsing who's one of my sponsees for a very, very long period of time. And I trapped him in a situation, and this is how I did it. I said to him, look, you have to have a desire to stop drinking to be a member of AA. I used that old requirement for membership in AA. And I said, I want to explain something to you. You're a continual relapser, okay? You continue to relapse, and you and I both understand it's because you are stopping at step four and step five or step eight and step nine. You always stop somewhere in the step process. Well, here, I'm going to challenge you with this. If you don't go through the step process within 30 days with me, you will be proving to me that you don't have a desire to stop drinking. Because you and I both know that your grace period is under 30 days. If you don't get firmly implanted in a spiritual experience within 30 days, you're going to drink. So if you're not on amends at the end of 30 days, you do not have the desire to stop drinking. You do not fit the requirement for our membership. And you got to hit the road. and I trapped him in this, and he really didn't know which way to go. Right now, he's really trying with the step process. I don't think that he made it to amends yet, but we'll see how that goes. Now, that leads me into willpower. How can you use the willpower? You can use your willpower to do the steps. Your willpower is sufficient to get yourself involved and started on this spiritual program. The spiritual program laid out in this book is possible for us to do. In my case, I know God jumps in and helps me where I need help if I'm willing and if I'm participating in this process. And so that's where I can use my will. I can use my will to show up at meetings. I can use my willpower to work the 12 steps. And I can use my willpower to be of service where it's appropriate and available. And with that, I can actually use my willpower in my own benefit. Direct combat against alcohol with my willpower, I'm just not going to make it. Anyway, much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, directions are put back in here. We have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and this needs more action. I believe that I've been taken to a point where I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. I'm at that point with an awakened spirit where I'm just able to do things that I never was able to do before. Anybody that's gone smack dab into the belly of the beast on some of these really unbelievable 12-step calls, you'll have to agree with me that we're just not smart enough to know exactly what to do in some of these situations. We have to rely on intuition. We have to rely on God guidance in some of these areas. And some of the areas, when I'm knocking heads out there in the real world, it's the same thing. I just don't think that I'm up to the job by myself, but I'm at a point with an awakened spirit where I can intuitively, and intuitive means without knowing without conscious thought, knowing without thinking about it. Sometimes I'm at that place where I really know what to do. I have to rely on that, you know, in this situation here tonight. If I really started to think about, well, what exactly am I going to say? How am I going to cover all this stuff? I'd direct our thoughts and actions and have us say what you will have us say. And that, number one, takes us off the hook. And number two, hopefully brings us to a point where we intuitively know how to carry the right message, the message that needs to be carried. I believe a lot in step 10. I use it today because I've learned through past experience that I suffer when I don't use it. And I don't like to suffer anymore. That emotional suffering of, you know, doing the wrong thing and not taking care of it or lying and not admitting it, all those little things, that gets me today. You know, I've become very, very sensitive spiritually. And I guess that's a good thing because step 10 really tries to, really allows me to try to live a better life when I use the tools. And let's see, is there anything else? How about the 10-step prayer for growth and effectiveness? Here's another prayer that Dave has written up for the 10th step. And let's all get in touch with this.
On page 15 of your guide.
God, please help me watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up in me, help me to immediately ask you to remove them from me and help me discuss these feelings with someone. Father, help me to quickly make amends if I've harmed anyone, to help me resolutely turn my thoughts to someone I can help. Help me to be loving and tolerant of everyone today. Amen.
Cool. Sit. Thanks, Chris. Mm-hmm. So there's some interesting quotes. You know the thing that Chris read on 85.1, it says, what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. From Pass It on page 254, correction, 252, it says, we only have a reprieve day by day, contingent on our spiritual well-being. But nothing more is sure than that our release can be perpetual if we make it so. In the case of the older members who have slips, the effect is to remind them of these eternal verities, or which means truths, of the alcoholic sickness. The slip invariably kicks them upstairs instead of down. AA is nothing more than capitalized grief. When I read that the first time, I thought I had to think about it for a while, and it really kind of hit me a little bit different than originally I thought, from a very arrogant position. Yeah, the old timers who have such, right, you know, yeah, it should kick them upstairs instead of down. And then I thought about it and said, wait a minute, there's only one thing that separates me from them, and that's one drink. You know, what an arrogant position to take. I need to learn from that. It's an eternal truth. If we don't maintain our spirituality, we are in danger of drinking, period. You know, and maybe that's the lesson I have to learn. You know, if my ego gets so out of whack, I'm in line for a slip, you know. And maybe if I'm lucky enough to get back, I'll learn the lesson. It'll kick me upstairs instead of down, you know. It's part of the hardest, probably the hardest thing I have to do in AA. The longer you're sober is to not take credit for your sobriety. Realize that it really is a gift from God. All of it. It's a total gift from God. And it's so arrogant, you know, because we hear it. And we celebrate. Chris was talking about celebrating. What's the purpose of a celebration? Listen, the next time you hear people celebrate when they get up there, and they'll tell you, at least in Jersey, a lot of times will say, tell us how you did it. And they'll get up there and they'll tell you for 10 minutes on how they did it, how they got 5 years of sobriety, you know, versus somebody who knows how they did it, and they get up there and they say, you know what? I didn't do it. God did it. And thanks be to God for this program. And then they acknowledge their family. Because the purpose of the celebration is for two reasons. It's one, to give credit to the family. It's their celebration. My family comes to my celebration. You know, I come from a men's group. We have an unwritten motto. It used to be written motto. I don't know if it's still written there anymore, and I haven't looked in a while. We have an expression that we use all the time. We say, if you think you're working this program, show us your family, and we'll tell you whether you're working this program. And we do that on anniversary night. We challenge each other. We know what's going on in each other's homes. You know, you just can't show up at that meeting and be good in that meeting. It does not fly. It's a little bit tougher than that, you know. The other reason celebrations are important is for the new guy, to know that it can be done, you know. It brings us back to the recovered versus recovering. Imagine what the newcomer is thinking when he sees somebody with 25 years say, hi, I'm Joe, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And he's saying, my God, he's still doing the deal at 25 years? In his mind, he needs to know that you can recover from the hopeless state of the mind and body. It doesn't mean the process does. But he needs to understand that there is an end line where that pain will go away and the promises do come. And it's not some 20, 25, 30, 35 years down the line. It can be a week, you know, if he gets into these steps. Right? Step 11. It says, but we must go further, and that means more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. Remember the proper attitude? Where do we see that? We saw it right before the fourth step, and we talked about searching within yourself as being the proper attitude. Lay aside prejudice. It would be easy to be vague on this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. And look at this. We jump into the nightly inventory. It says when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. You'll see in the big book, on page 86:1, there's actually 11 questions. Now, Dean, everything else in this program is 12, and the fact that I like 12, I originally started answering 11 questions at night, and then I found out that I wasn't really being completely honest. And if you look down through the questions, it says, where were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept things to ourselves that should have been discussed with another at once? And here's the key. Were we kind and loving towards all? I was going through after a while, and I'm doing these questions, and I say, you know what? I was kind towards everybody, so I must have been loving. And I just kind of gloss over it. If I was kind towards everybody, that question can answer with a yes. Today, I don't do that anymore. I split those into two separate questions, because my alcoholic mind can hide truth. I may have been kind to everybody today, but in my mind, I'm thinking, what a fat pig, or who is this jerk that just pulled out in front of me? That is not loving, but that's the voice. It goes off in my head. And I catch that, because what is that? That's the start of my character defect. That's the start of column three, right? The little voices that start popping up here and there when we're not getting our way and we're being condescending and judgmental. So for me, I split it up. I split that one instruction into two. I have two instructions. Was I kind towards all, and was I loving towards all? And that's where the 12 questions come. And you'll find those in the guide on page 15. You know, I put all the instructions in one place. That's why there's 15 of them. There's actually 12 questions that we're supposed to do every night. And at the very end, about the four sentences from the bottom of 86.1, it says, but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, look at this, we ask God's forgiveness and require what corrective measures should be taken. There's another, we ask God. Go ahead. Right, but it's listed in the 11th step. The reason it sounds like a 10th step is because if you read the 12 and 12, they're reversed, you know?
Yeah.
Bill Wilson, and this is kind of off the beaten track, so somebody may want to put your fingers in here.
Yeah.
The big book was written, when Bill Wilson wrote it, he wrote 10 and 11 very specifically. 10 is basically tools to work with as you go through your day. If you're agitated, doubtful, indecisive, they're giving prayers and actions to do as we go through our day. At the time of the history, and I'll go over some of the quotes of the history, it'll probably make more sense to you, be more clear, they were very specific about morning prayer and evening review. And they called it checking. They sit down there. You know how it's bad to take each other's inventory? In the beginning, that's what checking was all about. You feel this inspiration from God from your morning prayers that said, hey, move to Tibet and become a monk, rather than just jumping on an airplane and going to Tibet, you check it with somebody and say, hey, I got this in my morning meditation. I got this presence. This God's telling me, do you think that's possibly right? Before you end up in Tibet, why don't you check it with somebody? We take each other's inventory. We give each other spiritual license. Bill goes into terrible depression. He has all kinds of stuff. He gets away from 12-stepping. He's offsetting of world service. He's got these terrible emotional problems going on. What's he gotten away from? He was still doing the morning meditation and the evening review sometimes, not always, but he really wasn't doing much 12-step work. He couldn't go be with his people anymore. Anytime he'd go to a meeting, they'd recognize him and they'd say, oh, Bill, come on up here. They're putting him up on the pedestal all the time. He was always having to talk and explain, right? Finally, he hits the spiritual bottom. Everybody's saying, hey, Bill, you need to go through the steps. You need to get back on the spiritual being. You're way out in left field. Do it before you get drunk. He goes back through, there's another inventory process, he's back on the spiritual being. At the same time, he gives AA over to World Services at the convention. He gets this monkey off his back. His job is done. It's the end of our beginning of AA. The program's going to run by itself. And I've been bugging him for a long time in the grapevine to write these essays. Write some essays and explain more about the force of explain more. So he's written a whole series of essays. But at the World Service Convention, Bill really wanted people to get on the tradition bandwagon. He had a really hard time to get people to buy off on the traditions. So he got this brainstorm. He said, hey, I'll take the traditions, I'll put them in a book with these essays that everybody wants me to write about the 12 and 12, and they won't want to read the book for the essays, but at least if I put some steps in there, they'll buy the book, and hopefully they'll pick it up and read it for the essays as well on the traditions. Bill didn't edit the book.